We're glad that you're back this evening and appreciate the fact that God has blessed us to where that we're able to be here. And we're hopefully that some who are not able to be here will be able soon and to be back with us. We already announced this morning what we were talking about tonight. I want to turn to Exodus, the first chapter and verse 8, one verse to begin with. Exodus 1 and verse 8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. A new king who knew not Joseph. Now sometimes when I'm talking to young folks, I use some of this material because I think Joseph is an excellent example for young folks. But sometimes we forget that he is an example throughout his life, not just to young folks, but to middle-aged folks and old folks as well. And so I want to talk about Joseph, a man worth knowing. And it's a pity that this Pharaoh rose up and forgot all the great things that Joseph had done for Egypt. As a matter of fact, it had not been for Joseph. Of course, Joseph had God's hand in it. But it had not been for Joseph, Egypt would have been in a bad shape. And it would have, no doubt, have suffered from the famine that their neighbors suffered from during the time that Joseph was managing the affairs of Egypt. But, as I say, it's a pity that one doesn't know Joseph. Of course, all we know about Joseph is found in the Scriptures. But what's found in the Scriptures gives us some insight concerning Joseph and really what a great person he really was and what a great example he is for all of us. But I'm afraid that in our day and time that there are millions of young people even who leave home never having heard of Joseph, never having heard the story of Joseph and not knowing about Joseph, and that's a pity. And anyone at any age should be a better person as a result of knowing about Joseph and knowing what Joseph was and who he was and what he did. The life of Joseph can be divided, I think, into two parts, and that's what we want to talk about tonight. It can be divided under two headings. One of them is Joseph the victim, and the other is Joseph the victor. The victim and the victor. Let's look first at Joseph as a victim. First thing that we notice in Joseph's life that was really not to his advantage was that he was a victim of his father's partiality. If you go back and notice the story of Joseph, Joseph was the young child of Jacob. And because of the fact that he was not only his young child, but also he was a child of his favorite wife, and that being the case, he lavished upon Joseph a great deal of attention and a great deal of goods, for that matter, and openly showed his favoritism toward this child, this Joseph. Notice in the 37th chapter of Genesis, and in verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peacefully unto him. Here Joseph is the son of old age. And it says that Israel, that would be Jacob, that he loved Joseph more than all his children. When our children were growing up, and after they were nearly grown, when Jonathan came along, their way to tease us was talking about Jonathan was being the child with the coat of many colors, that we paid more attention to him. We denied it. But anyway, that was the way they had of kidding us. Well, in this case, Joseph did receive a great deal of attention from his father, and because of this partiality, as partiality always will, it breeds resentment and strife when there's partiality shown in the home. You try as you best, of course, sometimes, and maybe we are partial at times. But the ideal and the goal is, if in a home, if one has several children, to try as much as they can to treat them all alike and not to be partial one toward another. And but in this case, he was overly partial toward Joseph, and so it finally came home to roost for him to be sure. Notice also in the 37th chapter at verse 33 of Genesis. "And he knew it, and said, is my son's coat." Now this is after they had taken Joseph. They had sold him down into bondage. And how that they had taken his coat, and they soaked it in the blood of the animal, and then they carried it to the father and showed him the coat. And notice the agony that brought when he thought he was dead. "And he knew it," that's talking about Jacob, "and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. And Joseph rent his clothes, put sackcloth upon his loins, and mourned for his son many days." Here's an interesting lesson in passing, is that sometimes things are not always as they seem to be. And also, the lesson is that sometimes a person can sincerely believe something and it not be so. And here's a case, in the case of Jacob, he believed that his son was dead. The evidence that they presented to him at least pointed in that direction. And he mourned for many days, and all of his sons and all of his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and said, "For I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him, and the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and the captain of the guard. Now, this partiality that Jacob has shown now has come back to bite him. He had built a resentment, and I'm not going to put all the blame on Jacob, because the sons had their responsibility in it, of course. But this partiality had caused such resentment among the brothers that they went to that length. First of all, they planned to kill him. And then they, through the intervention of one of the other sons, they did not kill him, but they put him in a pit. And then ultimately they sold him down into bondage, down into Egypt. Of course, as we see the story develop later on, we see that God used that to his advantage. And it was God's way of saving the Israelite people from extinction by their going down into Egypt later on. But that didn't remove the guilt of Jacob and his partiality, nor the guilt of the sons, because God was able to work that to his advantage. And he did. So this partiality, showing partiality, disrupted that family in such a way that it brought sorrow and upon sorrow, especially to the father. And the thing that we need to understand also, that partiality, not only in families, but also even in congregations, can work havoc. The Bible teaches us that to the best that we can, that we are to do all things without partiality, without respect of persons. And he warns those who teach, like he warned Timothy as well as Titus, that when they preached, they were to do it, and they rebuked. They were to do it without partiality, without favoritism. And sometimes we can treat one another in congregations with such partiality, showing favor of one above another, until we can cause strife within a congregation, and that's not right either. So that doesn't mean that we can't have good friends, and doesn't mean we can't have special friends. But when it gets down to the rock bottom, we want to be of such that we do not discriminate and against another. We do not show partiality on the basis of wealth or on the basis of ethnic background or anything like that. That we do the best that we can to be fair and equal in our dealings one with another, and not let one, as the old saying goes, get away with murder unnoticed, and then the next one can do the least thing and then jump all over him because you prefer one above the other. We should treat one another as best we can as equals, and treat one another as best we can in a way that we do not show favoritism toward each other. And when that partiality gets within a congregation, it causes problems. And James warns against that in James chapter 2, verses 3 through 10, where he says, "And you have respect to him that weareth a gay clothing." Now, here's the background. He says that a man that comes into your assembly, talking to the brethren, he says comes into your assembly, that being to the local church assembly. He comes into your assembly and he has every appearance of being wealthy and being a person of means. And he says, and you have respect to him that weareth a gay clothing, and say unto him, sit thou in a good place, and say to the poor, stand thou there, or sit here under my footstool. I've always said that there any place on earth that people ought to be able to meet together and sit down together and do it feeling like they're on equal footing, it ought to be in the assembly of our Lord among God's people. That is, rich or poor, doesn't matter. That we ought to look upon each other as equal rather than preferring one above another. And he is warning the brethren there about showing favoritism toward a person because he has the appearance of being rich. And so he said, are you not being partial in yourselves and become judge of evil thoughts? Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him? But ye have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Do not they blaspheme and word that worthy name by which you are called? If you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbors thyself. But if you have respect of persons, you commit sin and are convinced in the of the law as transgressors. Whosoever shall keep the whole law depending in one point, he says, is guilty of all. So he says you are committing sin when you show that partiality. And if there's one thing that ought to make our, maybe not our blood boil, but at least make us sit up and take notice, is when people discriminate against people in the church because of their finances, because of their lack of wealth, or because of their social standing, or some other means. It's just not right. And we see it sometimes in school systems, and that's not right. So we ought to be such that we are not feeling ourselves better than somebody else, or feeling that someone is better than somebody else because of what they may own, or what their fleshly status may be. We need to learn to not show partiality, not have respect of persons. And this partiality that was shown by Joseph's father resulted in some awfully bad things happening to Joseph and caused him to be a victim of that partiality. But not only that, but he's also a victim of his brother's hatred and envy. As I said, what the father did may have provoked that hatred and envy on the part of the brothers, but that did not absolve them of their responsibility. They did have, as it were, to take the bait. Because Joseph may have been treated with favoritism, that was wrong, all right enough. But that didn't give them the right then to react to it with hatred and envy and wanting to murder him, wanting to do him harm. That's no excuse. They were freeborn agents, and they could and they should have acted in a way as people of God should act, rather than setting their heart on harm for Joseph. They should have risen above that envy and hatred that was being generated by the father's partiality, and to have looked with kindness and love on their brother. But notice in Genesis 34 and verse 37, verse 4, and when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peacefully unto him. It got bad. It got so bad, not only did they hate him, but they couldn't have a good word to say to him. They couldn't speak peacefully to him. And Joseph dreamed a dream and told his brethren, and they hate him yet the more. Now, Joseph, again, had the dream, and we have to, in the background of it, we know that that dream was inspired of God because it told Joseph what was going to happen in regard to his brothers, how that they would ultimately bow down to him, and which they did later on down in Egypt. But their reaction to it was hatred and envy, and they even began to call him the dreamer as a result of it. And in verse 11 of 37, and his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. So they envied him. Envy. There's no telling how many other sins have been perpetuated by envy. Envying the good fortune of another. Envy the attention another gets. Envy what another has. Envy the abilities and the envy of the even the good traits that people have. Envy can cause a great deal of harm. And they envied him because of his dreams, and hated him because of dreams, because he openly a dream that, and I'll not take the time to read all of it, but you find that also in the 37th chapter, that he had the dream that there were those in the field binding sheaves, and he said, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. Behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. That is, they're going to bow down to him as one in power and in authority. And in another, he dreamed that there was a sun and a moon and 11 stars made obeisance to him. That happened. That was God's prophecy concerning what was going to happen to the children of Israel in relationship to Joseph. And of course, he told it to his father. And, his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and my mother and my brethren, that's talking about the sun, the moon, the 11 stars, indeed come down and bow ourselves to thee, to the earth? And they did. They did come and eventually bow to him. Now, as I said, that was inspired of God, but the point I want to make, no matter what Joseph did or said, no matter what the father did or said, right or wrong, it did not excuse the envy and the hatred that these brothers had for Joseph. And we have to learn a lesson that we can't excuse ourselves on what somebody else does. I can't control what folks do to me, but I control my reaction to it. And I can't control the bad things that someone may say about me, but I can control my reaction to what they say. And I can control it by not retaliating. I can control it by having the proper attitude toward them in spite of what they may do unto me. And as Jesus taught, that they may say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. But he says, you rejoice because of the reward that you have later on. So their hatred festered in their minds until they did some awfully irrational things. They did things that didn't make sense. First of all, it caused them to be so angry and so envious of him that they were ready to put him to death. Notice in the 19th verse of the 37th chapter. And they said to one another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, in verse 20, come now, let us slay him and cast him into some pit. And we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. That didn't make sense. Kill him, cast him into a pit. Sooner or later, that's going to be found out. Sooner or later, somebody would find out about it, and they would be in trouble. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast into the pit that's in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So Reuben tried to save him. And it came to pass when Joseph was come to his brethren that they stripped Joseph out of his coat, his many colors that was on him, and they took him, and of course the story, you know, they cast him into the pit. And then after they'd done that, they even sat down and ate bread and lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead. Notice, they just cast their brother into a pit. Oppositionally to let him suffer, maybe he'll die there. And they just sat down and ate. And then they looked and saw the Ishmaelites coming. And they sold him away into bondage. And then they tried to cover it up by the coat and soak it in the blood. None of that really made good sense. But then they know that sooner or later, somehow or the other, their sins would find them out. But they didn't act rationally. They didn't act like people of God ought to, children of God, God's chosen people should, much less act like a human being. And so all of that, out of envy and hatred, and if we're not careful, we can allow envy and hatred to cause us to do some awfully cruel and even silly things to other folks, and we need to be careful about it. But the Bible tells us that in James 3:16, for where envy and strife is, there's confusion and every evil work. Where there's envy and strife, there's confusion. And so he was a victim of his brothers, their envy and their strife. But later on, after he was sold down into Egypt, and he got down there, and he was put over the house, God bless him, and put him over the house of Potiphar, a very prominent official in the Egyptian government. And so he was in that house and was given full stewardship over the affairs of Potiphar. And he went on to state that Potiphar had not held anything back from him except for his wife. And he was in this high position. And then he becomes a victim of a vicious lie. In the 39th verse, or the 39th chapter of Genesis 14, that his wife, that's Potiphar's wife, that she called unto the men of her house and spake to them, saying, see, he hath brought in a Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. Now this is after she had spent days and hours trying to entice him into an adulterous relationship with her. Evidently, Joseph was a fine-looking young man, person that was that appealed to her. And so she was trying every way she could to get Joseph in bed with her. And it didn't work out. It didn't go that way. And so what she did, she made up a lie. And so here's her lie. And it came to pass when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her until the Lord, his Lord, came home, and she spoke unto him according to these words, saying, the Hebrew servant which thou hast brought unto us came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, as I lifted up my voice and cried, they left his garment with me and fled out. And it came to pass, when the master heard the words of his wife, which he spake unto him, saying, after the manner of thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. Now, which are you going to believe, your Potiphar? You're going to believe what this young foreign Hebrew servant tells you, or are you going to believe what your wife is? And so he believed what his wife told him. It was a lie. It was a vicious lie. But it caused Joseph then to be in prison again, and caused him to lose his freedom because of that lie. He was in prison, according to the 20th verse, and Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound. He was there, and he was there in prison. Lying always hurts folks. Lying is never good. It can destroy souls. It can destroy friendships. And it can destroy lives. But the worst part about it is not what it can do to other folks, but what it can do to the person who's doing the lying. That's the worst part of all of it. And notice what it says in Revelation 21:8. But the fearful, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, whoremongers, sorcerers, adulterers, and all liars shall have their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Lying, unrepented of, cause one to go to hell. All liars, not white liars or black liars or whoppers or fields. All liars, he says, of how the part in the lake burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So if you can't depend on what folks tell you, things get to be in an awful shape. But there are those who lie. And it always has and always will, as long as this world stands. Now, a lie may hurt the person that's lied about a great deal. But I tell you what, a person lies about you, and lies about me, and lies to me, are lies to you. That person's lie could cause you a great deal of physical, temporal agony and pain. But it can do nothing compared to what it can do to the person who does the lying. Not only, even if he doesn't have a conscience, but if he has a conscience, certainly it's going to bother his conscience. But if he doesn't have a conscience, it's seared, then he's going to face in the world to come. And in the world to come, all liars have their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. So Joseph was a victim of a vicious lie. In the long run, it didn't hurt him. In the short term, it did. It caused him to be put into prison and caused him to suffer that. But in the long run, it did not hurt him. In the long run, it turned out, because of God's providence and help, that was to his advantage and to the advantage of his people, that he was in that prison and was elevated out of the prison into the very inner circle of Pharaoh's power, and was able to manage the affairs of Egypt for a number of years, and to save Egypt from a famine and to save his own people from starvation. So, though Joseph was a victim of a number of things, that partiality and the hatred and the envy of others and the lying, who was the victor? He was the victor in all of it. He won the battle. And it was victory through God's providence. God overruled the evil that was done to Joseph to fulfill his purpose. And that is purpose being to save a nation that was ultimately to be the nation of the Savior, the nation through whom the Christ would come and would save the world. And had it not been for these events, then you could at least argue that they would have been starved to death in the land of Canaan and would have gone into extinction. Of course, because of God's providence, that was not going to happen. And because of his providence, he brought about the circumstances. In spite of the lying and the envy and the strife that was promoted toward Joseph, he brought about circumstances whereby Joseph was able to bring those people out of a land that was virtually starving to death into a land that had plenty because of God's managing through Joseph the affairs of the Egyptian government. So he used Joseph to save the Messianic nation from extinction. In 45 and verse 5 of Genesis, after the children of Israel had been brought down, and there's a long story of that, and we would not have time to tell half of it, of all that took place, that ultimately brought Joseph, brought Joseph's family down to where Joseph was in Egypt. You remember the story that was going back and forth about the grain and the cups and so forth that to identify Joseph as the cup bearer and all that. But there's a lot that took place, but all of it resulted finally in Joseph sending for lack of a better expression for today, a wagon train, might be a camel train, excuse me, or whatever, back up into Egypt to bring all of his folks down there. And then after he makes himself known to his brothers who had sold him away, this is his explanation of it to his brothers in Genesis 45. Now therefore be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither. For God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land. Yet there are 5 years in which there shall neither be earing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and save your lives by great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent him hither, but God. The idea here is not you that sent me hither. The idea is not you only that sent me here. They had a part in it. But it was not you only, but it was God was the back of it. But God. And he's made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout the land of Egypt. So he says, God has worked it out to save you and to save the children of Israel. Now, this is not just saving any family. It's not just a saving of any nation. This is a saving of a particular family, a particular nation, for a particular reason. And that was that through the descendants of Abraham, and a particular descendant of Abraham, the nations of the earth were going to be blessed. Through the descendants of Abraham, there was going to be a great nation. And there's going to be a great land given to that nation. And out of that nation with that great land was to come one seed. And that seed was Christ, our Messiah, which would save not only Israel but the world from their sins. And God uses this to that advantage. And so through the providence of God, Joseph was actually the victor more than he was the victim in the things that transacted. In Genesis 50 and verse 20, "But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive." That's what God had in mind, saving a lot of folks alive. So through the providence of God, he obtained victory. Then he had victory through his perseverance, through his faithfulness and not giving up and not giving in. In Genesis 50:24, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land that he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So he says, I'll die, but God's going to visit you. He's going to come to you as a people, and he's going to bring you out of this land into the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. That would be the land of Canaan. So he says he's going to bring you out. Now, this is when he died. He's going to bring you into that land. This is when Joseph was on his deathbed when he said this. He said, I die, and this is what's going to happen. And that shows us that Joseph maintained his faith in his God in a foreign land among the Pharaohs who are idolatrous worshipers. He preserved it, first of all, through slavery. Secondly, he did it through imprisonment. And thirdly, he did it through prosperity in the governorship of the land. Now, if a man can maintain his integrity and maintain his faith in God through such hard times as slavery and imprisonment, and such a time when the whole nation looks upon it with praise and honor and glory for what he's done in the governorship position, and he can maintain through all of that, he will persevere. He will be one who will stand solid even unto death. And he didn't blame God for his brethren's mistakes. His brothers did some awful things. His father showed his partiality. They made mistakes. But Joseph maintained his faithfulness and didn't blame God for any of those mistakes. And for years, I've heard this saying over and over again, and I've made it myself, is that when trouble comes and when things happen, I try not to blame God for men's mistakes. I try not to blame God for my brother's mistakes. Sometimes they make some terrible blunders, but I try not to blame God for it. There are a lot of people, someone can do something within the church that they ought not to do, and people, they won't say they blame God for it, but they quit the church and they quit the Lord because of what some brother did. It didn't have enough sense to get it out of the rain, and he did something that was offensive, and so they just throw in the towel and give up the Lord and give up the church. Well, they may not say it that way, but they're blaming the Lord for man's mistakes, and we can't afford to do that. And I always try to tell my children, and I always try to, that all during your life, try never to blame God for what people do. Because people make mistakes. People sin. People sometimes are controlled by the devil. But don't blame God for those. Stay faithful to him. Stay loyal to him. Because he's always faithful. And Joseph was able to persevere because he didn't blame God for his position while he was in prison. He didn't blame God for having been thrown into the prison and to slavery, didn't blame God for all the hardships that he had to go through. He maintained his faith and integrity in him. And it was not only a victory through perseverance, it was a victory through purity of life on his part. He had to be of a pure heart to exit or go out from Potiphar's house with a pure life. After all, after the temptation that Potiphar's wife, he's a young man here at this time, and after the temptation of Potiphar's wife, he didn't yield. And after she lied to him, he did not react in any way to tarnish that purity. And so he had to have a pure heart to have acted in such a pure fashion. And the reason for his purity is very simple. God. Notice what he said in Genesis 39 at the house of Potiphar. And when he talks to Potiphar's wife, when she's trying to get him to sin against God and sin with her, he says, "There is none greater in the house than I. Neither hath he kept back," talking about Potiphar, "anything from me but thee. Because thou art his wife, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" How can I do this and sin against God? He remembered God in the midst of it. No wonder that the psalmist said that we need to hide his word in our hearts, that we sin not against him. And so he was victorious because of the purity of his heart and because he kept God at the center of it, through all of it. And in doing that, he came out of all of it, as we use the term sometimes, smelling like a rose, because of the person and the character that he was. Now, Joseph, the victim, could have easily allowed himself to be destroyed by bitterness, but he didn't. He could have by resentment, and allowed himself to get destroyed by discouragement when things went wrong, but he didn't. He stayed loyal. So Joseph, as a victor, overcame because that he understood, first of all, the workings of God's providence, and secondly, because he understood the seriousness of God's displeasure. Joseph was a person worth knowing. It's a pity that there rose up a king that later did not know him. And it, of course, caused a lot of problems when he forgot Joseph. But we don't have to forget him. We can use Joseph as an example of the kind of life that all of us need to live. He was not the Christ. He was not the Savior. But he was a hero of faith of old that's worthy of our imitation. And it's held up as a hero of faith by the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 11 when he mentions him among all of those who by faith had done thus and so. You may be here tonight some way subject to the Lord's invitation. If that's the case, then we encourage you to come while we stand, while we sing.